Welcome to SCI Science Perspectives, a podcast brought to you by the American Spinal Injury Association. In this podcast, we'll be discussing emerging literature spanning the full spectrum of SCI research, from discovery to clinical application. You're listening to a combined perspectives episode with Ms. Jennifer French and Mr. Ian Burkhart. I'm your host, Faria.
And I'm David. Today, we'll be discussing the topic of implanted neurological technologies. This topic was suggested to us by Asia's Communications Committee, and our guests today are Ms. Jennifer or Jen French and Mr. Ian Burkhart. Jen French is the founder and executive director of Neurotech Network, a nonprofit organization that focuses on education and advocacy of neurotechnologies. Concurrently, she is part of the American Brain Coalition, which has a coming congressional briefing on the Hill that you're invited to join on June 24th. Jennifer has been featured in several media outlets and is an accomplished writer and speaker, addressing organizations such as the National Academy of Sciences, the World Science Festival, and TEDx Talks. As a result of a snowboarding accident, Jen lives with tetraplegia due to a spinal cord injury. She is an early user of an experimental implanted neural prosthesis for paralysis. Ian Burkhart is a C5 complete tetraplegic from a diving accident in 2010. He is the founder and president of the BCI Pioneers Coalition and current president of the North American Spinal Cord Injury Consortium. After participating in a few clinical trials, Ian understood the need for engagement of individuals with lived experience from the start. Ian was the first person in the world to restore movement to a paralyzed limb using a BCI, brain-computer interface, neuroprosthetic. His research focuses on amplifying the lived experience of people with disabilities. Importantly, both Jen and Ian founded and maintain groups that leverage the lived experience of people living with paralysis in neuroscientific inquiry and neurotechnology development. North American SCI Consortium was previously mentioned, and relevant to today's topic, both Jen and Ian are contributing leaders of the Implantable BCI Collaborative Community, or IBCICC, a multi-stakeholder forum dedicated to advancing regulatory science in BCIs. So, for Ian and Jen, welcome to the pod.
Great. Thanks to be here.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Just as a starting point, I think it will be useful for all four of us, your two hosts and your two guests, to say a bit about our experience with implanted neurotechnologies. So if Jen or Ian, one of you wants to go first.
Certainly. I'll go first here. I was first introduced to implanted neurotechnology after my spinal cord injury and was looking for more ways to improve my quality of life and condition and looked for research to do that. And I was introduced to a clinical trial that was using brain-computer interface implanted in the motor cortex along with external muscle stimulation to restore hand and arm function for tetraplegics. And that was something that I was very interested in and, you know, participated in the trial for about 7.5 years.
Fantastic. And Jen?
Yeah, so my introduction to neurotechnology is similar to Ian. I was injured 27 years ago. 26 years ago, I was implanted with a neural prosthesis developed out of Case Western Reserve University. I've been fortunate enough to be able to use that technology for the last 26 years as a long-term study. Projecting from that, from my career, I went off into the neurotechnology space. I thought it was really intriguing. So, you know, started the nonprofit, but even more so have worked in industry, helping a lot of startups actually develop their pitches and trajectory from there. So it's not just being a user, but also understanding how the products develop and we bring them to market.
Great. Faria?
So my experiences with implanted neurotechnologies is going to be more so based with like intrathecal baclofen pumps or spinal cord stimulators. So it's more for spasticity and pain management, and not as much related to recovery or functional restoration at this point.
Fantastic. And as a neuroscientist at a research center that really champions translational research, and what I mean by that are the clinical trials that are seeking an FDA indication, I have been blessed to work with a number of the categories of implantable neurotechnologies that we'll discuss today. But as I'll probably share a little bit more later, especially on the implanted brain-computer interface, the IBCI side of things, I've had some very unique experiences, obviously not implanted myself, but working with people who are implanted. So there we go. There's our positionalities on this topic for all four of us. So kicking us off right here, just to really explicate this for the listener, there are two main technologies we'll be talking about. One is an implanted brain-computer interface. That's a sensor. It detects brain activity. All it does is it listens. Essentially, it reads. It does not write, if you'll allow my analogy. And the other technology we'll be discussing are implanted electrical stimulators, or as Jen said, like a neural prosthesis. So that's going to be something implanted somewhere in the body, either the spinal cord, a peripheral nerve, or the muscle. And it's going to use most likely electrical stimulation to turn things on. So it writes, it puts energy in. Great. So on those two topics, Ian, Jen, if you would like to say what you're currently most excited about, and you can start with either of those.
What am I most excited about? Wow. In the field of neurotechnology, I think I'm most excited about the translation of technologies and how quickly they've evolved from the launch of the Brain Initiative. Geez, what was that, 12 years ago? So I'm really excited to see the development of neurotechnologies in the area of spinal cord injury. I'm really excited about the advancements of two things. One is spinal cord stimulation and how much we've learned over a period of time in terms of how it helps not only with rehabilitation, but also for potential uses as a prosthetic. But I'm also really excited about brain implants as well and how we can actually utilize the brain and the central nervous system to help overcome so many neurological conditions and not just spinal cord injury.
I would say I'm really excited about the transition between both of those that you mentioned, David. So the recording portion of implanted brain computer interfaces and the simulation function of implanted muscle stimulators to really be able to help restore function to those who have lost it due to paralysis or another neurological issue. And being able to then have all sorts of facets below that of using a implanted BCI to help someone communicate, use a computer, but then also drive another device, and then adding into that even stimulating the brain to restore the sensation of touch, and just allowing individuals with disabilities to have as much independence in their own life and being able to do things that, for many, many years, people would always say, you're never going to be able to do that again.
Yeah, this is fantastic. So, it comes to device control, motor, sensation, digital ADLs, activities of daily living. This is so good. Ian, you're like touching on everything that we want to disentangle a little bit here in the future. But starting off, like maybe you can set the stage a little bit, especially with the coming, or I would say we might even be there, state that IBCI is in the context of a meeting that I believe we all attended, in terms of Ian, Jen, myself, which was a joint meeting between the FDA and the NIH, which included kind of impetus from IBCICC. And this was a meeting where it was said in public that we're moving in IBCI research from an era of safety to an era of efficacy. And so, what that signals to me as a clinical trials professional is that we're no longer questioning whether or not these elective surgeries are something, that might have a safety profile that's not known. And it's just saying, go and do the thing and see how they can be good. And so I can't remember which or both of you were in attendance there, but do you want to comment at all on the history of this, the attempts right here with IBCI, and where we came from?
Yeah, so I'm happy to start that off because in 2024 we launched the Implantable Brain Computer Interface Collaborative Community, and just so your audience can have a little better understanding of what collaborative communities are, there's only about 19 of them in the U.S. So these are multi-stakeholder organizations that are developed, but we also have something that's called a federal liaison letter. And that federal liaison letter allows our federal partners to come into the collaborative community and work with the various stakeholders, industry, patient advocacy organizations, clinicians, and to be able to help solve some of the systemic issues of translating the technologies. As the IBCICC, we're the first one in clinical neuroscience, and we're focused on translating IBCIs and really tackling a lot of the unknown questions around things like clinical outcome measures. How are we going to do? How are payers going to pay for this? What are we thinking about dual use of implantable BCIs? So, when you talk about and you reference that meeting and how are we going to have the trajectory of implantable BCIs, there's a cohort of industry representatives and companies out there that are really driving this technology forward to bring it to commercialization, to make it available for people living with various forms of paralysis and other neurological conditions. But how do we get over those barriers to commercialization and availability, working with all of these various players to help break down some of those systemic hurdles?
Yeah, that's great to hear because we know that in the implantable stimulator space, that these stimulators have had a medical indication for quite some time for sensation. And so from my perspective, it seems like the regulatory hurdles, it's a little bit more straightforward to assign a new indication or something like this, as opposed to brain computer interface. Ian, it looked like you were coming in.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to look at what type of outcome assessments are necessary to evaluate these types of devices. And, going back and looking at other types of devices that have been approved, they have much more of a clear clinical indication for use compared to where brain computer interfaces are right now and neuroprosthetics as a whole. A lot of these are life-enhancing devices versus life-sustaining devices, and I think that pushes on the regulatory and reimbursement side a little bit more of a challenge to understand how these can be approved and funded for. But I think that also opens up the conversation to allowing, many more people that would be able to benefit from these types of devices and what that means to each person is going to be different, and so that needs to be, included in the narrative as well.
Yeah, that's a great thing to, if I could just dovetail off of what Ian said. I think one thing we have to think about is particularly in the spinal cord injury space, where we get very excited about spinal cord stimulation, and it's been around for a really long time and decades for pain. Freya, you've worked with spinal cord stimulators, but when you work with the industry and you go to NANS, I mean, there's no doubt the industry has had issues. Just very recently, pushback on reimbursement from payers. So we can't think that, just because we're developing spinal cord stimulators for spinal cord injury, it's going to be a free and clear pathway to not only regulatory approval, but also payer and then access. So, we have to be able to work not only, we're talking about implantable BCIs, but we have to think about this for spinal cord stimulators as well, is how do we work collectively to get over some of these regulatory and payer hurdles and access hurdles so that people living with spinal cord injury can gain access to the technology.
That's a really fair point because we see that a lot in just in the clinical side of things where you have all the research going into potentially like new avenues of restoration of function and improvement of quality of life. And you'll have patients who will read up on the studies or read up on like the articles, and then they will come to you and ask you, like, all right, is this commercially available? Like, do I qualify for these things? And then you have to kind of maneuver that conversation of like, well, it sounds promising, it looks great, but then we've got X, Y, and Z barriers in the way. before it can really shine for these patients. And it's a really tough conversation to have of like, we got to wait until, something changes or it opens up for people. And then and you really are trying to do your due diligence as a clinician to give them that hope that, there is a lot of, the light at the end of the tunnel, and there are potential, technologies in the future. We just get there hopefully soon for them.
I think that's such a challenge for you. You do have, for me, when I was first injured, I was going to my providers, whether that be, clinicians or, my therapist, and asking what can I expect. And, it's not necessarily always in their purview to be up to date on all the latest and greatest research, but also you have that challenge of, you see a headline come across the news of like, oh, new hope for the paralyzed, or brain computer interface restores sensation for those with paralysis. And while that's great, it is once again another challenge as far as how you're going to be able to have access to these types of devices to the larger public. And what are all the considerations that really need to be, solved before it can be something that there is kind of that large scale adoption.
Yeah, we appreciate your lived experience led leadership in this effort. And also just quick plug for Sam Maddox if you want to get the headlines that are only the real thing. Since we broached this topic, and Ian, you brought it up first, of clinical outcome assessment. So just for some of our listeners who might not be familiar with this term, this is a formally defined term. There's four categories of these COAs, and this is the one thing I'm most excited to be asking both of you about. So, Jen, you invoked the stimulators, and so maybe we can start there. For both you and Ian, what do you think that the most meaningful COAs could be for something like an epidural spinal cord stimulator?
So, just for clarity, I don't have an epidural stimulator. My neural prosthesis is actually muscle based, and peripheral nerve based rather than central nervous system based. But I can't answer that question. And the reason I can't answer that question is because when we can really be able to pinpoint what a COA is for various technologies, it takes really doing some good community engagement and really doing the due diligence of the research to understand what is the concept of interest and what is the context of use of that technology to drive yourself towards a COA. I could talk about all the research that's been done on the priorities of people living with spinal cord injury. We've all read Kim Anderson's papers. We've read a lot of those published papers that are out there. Those talk about the various types of priorities, but when you start to pinpoint into where the COA is, you have to find alignment between the priorities of people living with the condition and the alignment between what is a clinical outcome.
And also then what the device can actually do, what the performance of that, is it something that, can really help with a activity of daily living, or is it something that's more so helping with, blood pressure management, bowel and bladder management, reduced spasticity, and all those lead into activities of daily living. But if the device, can't perform in a way that it aligns with both the end user's needs and then the regulatory and payer needs, then that's a device that probably isn't ready yet.
Yeah, absolutely. And yet, in the end, for every clinical trial, the principal investigator has to choose a primary outcome and the secondary and tertiary, however it's set up. And so, really appreciate our audience being able to hear how that can be done in a way that is reciprocal, that does have, feedback from the priorities of the community. So, maybe you can outline like what this process looks like, because it might seem a little overwhelming that for every single therapeutic, we're going to have to do like 50 studies to get concept of interest, context of use, and that might slow things down. So, what's being done right now to make it so that those exchanges can happen more quickly?
I'd say one of the biggest things to help progress that translation is making sure that you have individuals with lived experience that you're engaging with from the start, and that you're able to have a, sounding board of sorts to project ideas and see how that fits. And, while you're probably only getting a snapshot into the community, it's much better than, just looking at it from an engineering and clinical perspective and making guesses. And being able to involve those people, in a true manner and being part of the team, I think is going to be really helpful. So that way, when you're trying to determine what outputs, and endpoints make sense, it's something that makes sense on a clinical level and something that makes sense on a user level.
Absolutely. And you know what, there's frameworks and directives. You don't need to reinvent the wheel when it comes to this. So, you know, there's organizations like the National Health Council and PCORI who are putting out, you know, directives to help guide you through that type of development where you can build alignment between people with lived experience and the lived experience community, the clinical community, those in industry, those who are payers, those who are, you know, in the regulatory space. So, you know, building out that ecosystem, you know, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. There's already tools out there to be able to direct you to get to what is that good primary and secondary outcome measure for your clinical trial.
Perfect. If, dear listenership, you'll allow me, we as professionals no longer have an excuse for not doing this. All of the resources are available to us. The community is offering it. Ain't Jan and Ian are here, right? So here we are. This is our call to action, right? It should not be a call to action. It should be a call to be exercising what we've already been doing. But if I can just say, as someone who has put this up front and center in my, young millennial professorship, Ian's model of what he's saying, like if you do it on a small level, just in your local lab meetings, it's going to be a lot easier to scale it up to larger, like multi-site or organizational-based things. So just f find your local, t take your participants, ask them if they want to come to a lab meeting, and that's a great way to get started.
So I just want to, you know, kind of bounce ideas off with you guys with based on what we're talking about in terms of like, yes, it's, you know, I think Ian, you had mentioned it where kind of like it's not like a one size fits all concept, and you will have to cater and individualize it for the, you know, individual who is getting this type of technology. What are some perceived clinical like barriers that these patients will should anticipate of like, you know, do I qualify to be in this study or do I qualify to get this type of, you know, IVCI or STIM or neuromodulation? Is there anything from, you know, both of your guys' personal and professional experiences to be a guiding tool for people interested?
And I understand the question a little bit. I'm sorry. So is it more of people that are looking to participate in clinical trials, or more for people that are designing clinical trials?
Both.
Okay. Yeah. So I think there's one kind of concept to think of when you're looking at designing a clinical trial and then getting to actually recruitment is, I always point people to the FDA's, patient engagement guidance, where they do a very clear definition between a clinical trial participant and an advisor. And those are really two different roles. And I think the myth is that, I can't involve people with lived experience because I have a clinical trial going on and they need to consent into being an advisor. No, because those roles are two very different things. Yes, we need consent for clinical trial participation. But if you're looking at gaining advisement, it's no different from hiring a statistician or hiring a, some other CEOs, CRO, if you will, that's being a consultant to your the design of your clinical trial. It's no different. And the FDA actually defines it and puts guidance out there for it. So I think when we think about designing clinical trials and involving people with lived experience, really in helping to gain the perspective of understanding how to map out that clinical trial from the lived experience perspective. So many times we map out clinical trials based off of a clinician's perspective and not necessarily the lived experience perspective. So gaining that advisory role to be able to understand what the purview is of lived experience through your clinical trial will help you along the way, not only along that clinical trial, but also with recruitment and retention. So when you think about talking about technologies to people with lived experience and recruitment, there's a lot of facets that go with it of whether it's going to be an implanted device or a wearable. What are the requirements that are expected of people to be able to participate? What's their time commitment? What other kind of expenses that they might need to endure to be able to participate in the trial? And I'm sure there's other things I haven't even thought of, right?
Yeah, I think, Jen, you really mentioned the delineation between a, lived experience consultant and a participant. And I think that it's really important to have that clearly defined, but also understanding that people are people and they may want to, stop one role and switch to the other role based on their own, life experiences, and what's going on in their day-to-day. So I think it's important to acknowledge that and kind of, plan for that potentially being the case. And I think, especially when you're looking at, a particular trial, you have your inclusion-exclusion criteria that can then really help you start to recruit as to what types of individuals with lived experience you want to be on the consultant side and making sure that those, can be as diverse as possible, but still, specialized into the correct perspectives that you want for the particular intervention. And that way you can, kind of get the most out of it while still being able to, have future ideas because we don't live in a vacuum, right? You're going to probably have a trial or a project that will then stem off and go lead to something else in the future. So being able to be somewhat broad within that, and you can be much more broad in those advisors than you can be within the, recruitment and enrollment for your clinical trial.
Great. And then for the participants who are enrolling, if we were to combine something like a safety and then just perceived kind of ick, if you will, what do you think the primary hesitations are to electing for implantation in the context of what the FDA is going to call an investigational device?
One of the things that I hear quite a bit, and I've, experienced a little bit personally, is, if it is an implanted device, are you then, kind of putting all your eggs in one basket and not going to be a, not going to fit inclusion criteria for something that comes down the road that may be, that new shiny? So I think that's a challenge. Also, the challenge of support for a device and how much you're going to be able to use that. If it's only going to be within the clinical trial, or you're going to be able to use it outside of the clinical trial in your day-to-day. And, that's a whole nother consideration that you need to have. And if you're, a prospective participant in a clinical trial, make sure you have those conversations and ask those questions to the researchers prior to involvement. So that way you can have as clear of expectations as possible.
Yeah, and if I can add on to that, I mean, a couple of other considerations too that people think about is what's the infection rate? What's the recovery time? Will my local doctor be able to still treat me? I've lived a long time with an implanted device, and sometimes I go to physicians and they go, "Oh no, we can't touch you," because this is a device that they've never seen before. Is it MRI compatible? Can you get an MRI? What happens when the trial is over with if I have an implanted device? Does it get explanted? What happens If it does get explanted, what happens if I keep it and it gets infected? What happens if the company, if it's sponsored by a private company, what happens when the company goes out of business? Then, well, how would that device be maintained? So I think, addressing a lot of those questions up front are really important. And I think, again, that's where some of your lived experience consultants can help you walk through some of those questions and be able to prepare your clinical coordinators to be able to address those questions when they're going through recruitment, because they will inevitably come up.
Fantastic. And before we move on to our final topic here, I can't drop the COA since I have both of you here. And I really appreciate you invoking a process because this should be about a process and not the event. The point isn't so much the COA, but how we all come to arrive at the COA together. But for the category of IBCI, it's just so different, possibly, in terms of what we might arrive at for a COA because that COA might involve something that happens entirely digitally. So do you think that there's at least, if you close your eyes and squint, you can see shadows of what might be not the COA, but like a category of the primary outcome of implanted brain-computer interface? Is it going to have to be something like control of a robot, or could it be just device control?
I think certainly just device control is a category that can be there. It's the way that brain computer interface is generally positioned is that it is affecting some port, some sort of external device. And generally then you're looking at that device separately as far as what its capabilities of doing, whether that is controlling a robotic arm or it's controlling a muscle stimulator or it's just controlling the computer and allowing you to navigate the digital world. And so I think it's really critical to be able to look at those separately but also together, because without one without the other really leaves you halfway up the mountain. And so if you can't look at them together, then you're not going to have the full picture. But also you have to look at them separately a little bit to be able to mitigate some of the risk and some of the challenges of combining different devices, and knowing that if an individual gets an implanted brain computer interface, that they have the opportunity to use it to control so many different things. And so how does that change the conversation as well?
Yeah, there's two, it's a great point. And I think one of the unique things about implanted BCIs is that so many times we look at medical devices looking at a very specific clinical indication of what this device is for and how it's going to treat, right? And the unique thing about IBCIs is that, it can apply to multiple populations, multiple indications, and we have to start looking at this as a specific condition that could be related to a lot of other populations, like ALS, like MS, like a Lofton syndrome from a brainstem stroke. So we have to look at it a little bit differently than we've traditionally looked at medical devices very rigidly as a symptom for a very specific indication, where this is a much broader application. So I think it's a different way to look at benefit versus risk. And from a payer's perspective, really looking at cost effectiveness.
Yeah, fantastic. This does naturally lead into the last topic we have here. And Ian, you said before, this difference between life enhancing and life saving. And if you'll allow me to share one story I have with implanted BCI, and it was really where I had this shift from what was, rehabilitative to what was augmenting, so restoring function to augmenting function. And there's a young man, his name's German Daniel Aldana Zuniga. He has an ECOG implanted left side motor hand knob, and it was transmitting its signal to an 850 horsepower NASCAR Cup car, and he drove that car around a track using only his thoughts. And when I was there watching him do this, all I could think is, wow, I want to try. And he got first access, and that did not have a rehabilitative function, but he did do something that was essentially superhuman. And so that blurring of the lines of like, you get the first mover advantage by accessing these neurotechnologies that like talk to text, you know, starting with Dragon Speed back in the day. Now all of us use voice commands, right, for devices. Can you say a little bit about that role of lived experience in the neurotech development?
Yeah, so I think it is really interesting when you look at access to these types of devices, and right now you're only getting access within a clinical trial, and it's such a kind of narrow focus. As access increases, then you're going to have all sorts of different use cases, and that then once again changes that discussion into what are the, you know, outcomes that each individual will want to use a device for. And, you know, then when you're looking at the challenge between it being a, you know, research device that isn't, you know, the end target is rehabilitation, but isn't necessarily there yet. There is still a lot of benefit for that. You know, within the BCI Pioneers Coalition, you know, we have individuals who have participated in different clinical trials, and, you know, a lot of them have shared, you know, the overarching, you know, rationale for participation is, you know, wanting to, you know, kind of push science a little bit forward. But also, it really gives the participants a job and a way to, you know, actively contribute in to making this technology something that, you know, others will be able to benefit from in the future. So balancing the fact that it's, you know, something that's not ready for prime time yet, but there still is a lot of value out of it, is something that's challenging. And, you know, that then leads into different people who are starting to look into, is this right for me? You have to balance, you know, where you're at in your lifetime and, you know, how much time do you have to dedicate to this? You know, or do you want to wait for the next version that's a little bit more refined and able to be used by more and more people?
The other thing we have to think about is the comparator of a BCI. Are we comparing this to currently available assisted devices? So when we think about comparing a BCI to an assisted device that exists today, you know, are we creating an artificial floor for BCIs as when we think about it as a comparator, whether it's superior or inferior? But the question is this is an assisted device or is this an enhancing device?
Do either you feel like you have an answer to that question?
I don't really think there can be an answer because it's going to be really both as far as a assistive device and an enhancement device. Because, you know, enhancement is just changing the way that you're doing something. And like you said earlier, David, as far as, you know, voice dictation, it's something that, you know, was originally really developed for, you know, specific use cases, and now it's opened up to the general public. You know, I think BCI and other types of neurotechnologies are going to be in the same realm as far as it's something that, you know, is first looked at for very specific use cases, and then you start to have these devices out in the wild and you can use them for different things and allowing a lot of flexibility in there while still, you know, worrying about, or not necessarily worrying about, but protecting the safety of individual users. So that way they are able to, you know, have the most benefit to their day-to-day, you know, top priority or, you know, list of priorities that can improve their quality of life. And whether that's, you know, just talking about communication and using, you know, going from voice dictation to being able to use a BCI to have text input into a computer. Now you have a little bit of privacy from, you know, everyone around you, not necessarily needing to hear everything you're saying. And you can, increase that autonomy. And I think that that's really what these devices will be able to do is increase autonomy of the users. And that's what, to me, I think is most important.
Yeah, there's two thoughts to that. There are people, I mean, you're talking to two people that have had implanted devices, right? But there are people out there that says, no way, I don't want a device implanted in me. And there are, non-invasive BCIs. There's non-invasive technology that's being developed. And I think people need to understand, the evaluation and the use cases between an implanted device and one that is going to be wearable. So I think, there's a case for both of them. But I think we also have to clearly educate and understand what the advantages and disadvantages of each of those are. I think also the second thought is that, when we're looking at these new technologies, there's a lot of areas of innovation that have happened over a period of time. And we're now exchanging a lot of human data back and forth between a technology that either you're using and getting either neural data out of your brain or neural data out of your nervous system. And how are we approaching responsible innovation in that way, in how we handle people's neural data, in terms of how people have the use cases, and how we maintain those over a period of time.
Yeah, I'd like to stress kind of both of those points that Jen mentioned. There's, with an implanted device, it's really hard to be able to try it before you buy it, essentially. And so making that clear delineation as far as is this going to be worth it for each individual and each individual's own kind of considerations before electing to have an implanted device that, once again, is, life improving, not life sustaining, is a challenge. And very important, the side of kind of the data ownership and what data is being processed is, we currently live in a world of, commercial companies wanting to capture all the data and see what they can do with it and mine that data to be very valuable. And now you're looking at neural data, which is inherently private. And while these devices aren't reading your brain like a science fiction movie thinks of, it is reading information from your brain, and we still don't know exactly, everything that is captured from that and how much is, necessarily needed. From a standpoint of being able to do on-device decoding instead of sending it and sharing it with the company, and letting it, only capturing the data that is absolutely needed for it to work. Or, others might decide to opt in and, yeah, I'll share all my brain data because I want to help, the further development of these types of devices. But really making sure that individual users understand and there's not a discrepancy of information between those who, know exactly what they're getting into and those who are capturing this data from users. And just making sure that, at least without having a crystal ball, we're able to make the best informed decision as possible at the current time.
Yeah, if I can share, I'm teaching an ethics class coming up in fall. It's called Ethics of Technology, and implanted neural technologies are going to be the centerpiece of that class because this is at the cutting edge of bioethics, right? I mean, really. So, yeah, thank you both so much for coming, sharing your perspective, and Free is going to sign us off.
Yeah, just one thing that I wanted to ask, and you guys kind of mentioned it, of multiple considerations for individuals with lived experiences if they want to get involved in these types of studies and trials and, things that they have to think about. What is something that you could pass on to our listeners, people with lived experiences, if they want to get involved? How should they do it? What resources are out there for them just to guide them in the initial stages? And I think we can open that up to both the hosts and our participants.
Yeah, I think if you're looking to be more so an advisor to both research and various types of development in the on the commercial side, the North American Spinal Cord Injury Consortium, we have something that's called the Project Engagement database. So you're welcome to join that, and that's where opportunities come in, and we'll reach out to you and advisement opportunities that arise. For those that are fortunate to live in areas where there's large research centers, being involved and building that relationship with the researchers in those institutions can also help out as well. There's another way to get involved is the National Institutes of Health of National Institutes of Neurological Disorders and Stroke hosts a nonprofit forum every year. This year it's on June 25th. Because of the times that we're in, it's actually co-hosted with the American Brain Coalition and NINDS as a public-private partnership. So we encourage people to go to that event and be able to network as well to find opportunities.
I happen to also know that Unite to Fight Paralysis, a nonprofit grassroots SCI organization, has SCI consultants. You can go to their website, click a button that says intake form, and they'll try and match you with someone. And as a scientist who does engage people with the lived experience of paralysis in the design of science, I'll say if you're living with paralysis in any form, like just reach out to one of us. Science is done by scientists, and scientists are people. We can be influenced. And we have positive and negative biases and come and just win us over, right? You'd be surprised. A lot of people are very open to this. They just don't realize that the resources are there. If you lead them to the water, they're probably going to start drinking. So, yeah, these are all great.
That's so true. And there's also the SCI research advocacy course that's available on the North American Spinal Cord Injury Consortium website. So that's both for researchers and for people with lived experience to learn about their research process.
Yeah, I think that adds to a very valuable point that, humans are humans, and it really boils down to relationships. If you want to see science progressing in one way or another, you need to be able to have those relationships between the researchers and the end users, or the designers and the users of these types of devices, and understanding that, there's all sorts of motivating factors for why. One thing is exciting to one group of people or not. And, understanding that, if you really want to have high quality engagement and a collaboration between those users and designers, it really does boil down to just that relationship and making sure that you understand both sides of the decision-making platform.
Fantastic. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you here on the pod, and we really look forward to continuing on this beat. And if there's any major breakthroughs in these neurotechnologies, maybe we can have you back on. It's an absolute pleasure, Janine.
Thanks so much for having us. Thanks, David. Thanks, Freya. And thank you for everyone for listening.
Yeah, Freya, and David, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCI Science Perspectives, brought to you by the American Spinal Injury Association. The topic discussed in this episode was chosen based on the recommendation of Asia's Communications Committee. The podcast was founded thanks to the leadership of Dr. Suzanne Groh and is now made possible by your producer hosts, David McMillan, Freya Kalik, and Marla Petrello, our production assistant and editor, Abby Fox, and Asia's front office. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, please contact us at SCI Perspectives Podcast @gmail.com.